What's up, everybody? I'm back with another edition of the State of Bitcoin podcast, where I was joined in person with a very pregnant Katie the Russian. So shout out to Katie for powering it through and joining me when she could have been doing a lot of other things. So it was a great conversation talking about Plan B passports, the jurisdictional arbitrage, and, you know, the possibility of, you know, if something hit the fan. Shit hit the fan. What are you going to do? So big shout out to PlebLab too for hosting me. So I couldn't say it enough. Shout out to PlebLab. Support those guys down there. They're not officially a sponsor anymore, but maybe sometime in the future. But I think that everybody should support what they're doing and the great things that they're doing back down there. And bring it to my sponsors. Shout out to the Bitcoin Advisor. If you're looking to get your Bitcoin off an exchange and not quite sure how to do it, you've seen Celsius, BlockFi, you name it. Maybe some other ones that you want to get it just off of an exchange, off of Coinbase. Get it off of these other things just in case something happens. You can contact me at thebitcoinadvisor.com/greencandle. You can set an appointment directly with me and I can help you out. And shout out to Hodler's Official, the number one Bitcoin jerseys in the game. They got the Sega the Genesis pack with the baseball jerseys, white and black. You can get an orange basketball jersey with either Satoshi or Nakamoto on the back. All right. Enough for me. Let's get into the episode with Katie the Russian.
Bing bong. We are live from PlebLab here in Austin. So shout out to Carr for letting us use the space. But I'm here with Katie the Russian, who has been very generous to join me, very pregnant. So I appreciate it. Katie, how you doing today?
Doing very good. Having a great Saturday morning.
Yeah, it's a great Saturday morning down here in Austin, Texas. Well, you did just tweet out about El Salvador's new passport that they're allowing. The number one thing that I kind of want to start off with that I think is kind of catching people off guard is the price, like $1 million in order to get this passport. So I guess this is a two-part question. So one, is this like, I guess, I'm not really familiar with the pricing of other types of passports. So is this like way out there? And two, like, you know, what is, I did see your opinion video. What is your, kind of logic behind why they priced it so high seemingly in US dollars?
Yeah. So citizenship by investment industry is changing every day. And of course there are new programs coming in, other programs retiring, but comparing to what we have available on the market right now, El Salvador is definitely priced higher than anything else that is in the same kind of program set up, in the same kind of power of the passport league, right? So let's say, what is the best comparison would that be? For example, St. Lucia. It is an island nation, a Caribbean island. The program has been around for almost 10 years now. And the power of the passport is very similar because El Salvador passport has 130 countries visa-free or visa on arrival. Same goes for St. Lucia. It's 131 country visa-free or visa on arrival. In terms of taxation, we can also compare this feature. So it's pretty much for passport clients, the taxes are going to be very similar between the two as well. No capital gains on Bitcoin. There will be some capital gains on stocks in El Salvador. So if we just go feature by feature, those could be compared. However, we do know that El Salvador is taking a step forward with the Bitcoin policies. They do try to attract more capital. They are trying to be more libertarian. So they're like in this era of rising as a country, right? So that could bring it up in our comparison with St. Lucia. But now let's look at the prices. So full on total for St. Lucia would be around 130 grand. And full on El Salvador would be $1 million. So I think the program, like if you were to look into passport programs and you're just blindly looking for a plan B option, you're looking for a plan B passport, you probably wouldn't proceed with El Salvador again because it's overpriced. But the people who will go for El Salvador are basically there to support the country, support the policy, get on board with President Bukele and what he's doing with the country, and just show their appreciation for Bitcoin and what it's doing in the world. So for them, it would be more like, I support this country, what you guys up to. I'm going to give you $1 million and there's going to be a really nice bonus for me in terms of being recognized for my donation. And I'm going to get a pretty good password.
So what do you mean by like a pretty good bonus? Do you mean just like kind of like the notoriety to be like kind of helping out one of the first, countries that make El Salvador as, or that makes Bitcoin as legal tender like El Salvador? Or do you mean like bonus, like, I don't know, maybe more access to Bukele? Like what is kind of like the, what is your meaning?
No, I'm saying more like it's a philanthropy project. You're donating $1 million and then, oh, okay, I'm getting a passport, a pretty good hedge against my home country. Like that's a bonus.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, that makes a lot of sense. Okay. So then, so is this more of like, I guess, a second passport kind of program, or would this be, I guess, more of like, I guess, a replacement of citizenship, because you've used the word like, I guess, like investment type of passport. Is that correct?
Yeah. So the industry overall is called investment migration industry.
Okay.
Right. So this program, despite the name Freedom Visa, it is a true citizenship by investment program, citizenship by donation. So at the beginning, when they launched the program, there was no clarity on either it's a residency that you get through this donation, which that would blew my mind completely, mm-hmm. or either it's a citizenship, meaning that you are a full-on citizen of the country and you get a passport. So I had to get to the bottom of it, reached out to people who are involved with the program and got very much clarity that it is, in fact, citizenship by donation.
Okay.
And one of the cool thing about this program that is not something that any other program can offer is timeline. They basically already giving out passports to the first applicants who 2 weeks ago submitted their documents.
Oh, wow.
None countries in the world can offer that. No shortcutting, no additional payments to speed up the process would get you passport in 2 weeks anywhere else. So that could be a huge bonus. But again, now you need to look at, okay, who is this going to attract? Like a $1 million program that is going to get you a passport and it's going to get you in 2 weeks. Well, it might attract people who know that they're going to get in trouble in 2 weeks and they need it now, so they are ready to pay a high price. And then we also need to look at the paperwork. That was one of my biggest concerns with the program, because I know if the program is implemented incorrectly, this is going to attract the wrong crowd and it is going to hurt the locals a lot and the country a lot. So over the last 2 years, ever since the announcement, we've already seen a lot of pressure going for El Salvador from WEF, from world's elites, whatever that means. Basically, they don't like what Bukele is doing, but the country is so small that they don't care enough to really fight it yet. But, and also because it is happening inside the country, right? The new currency, the economic growth, it doesn't really affect other countries just yet. With a passport program, now you are giving away visa-free access to Europe Union to this new applicants. So now other countries do care, because that's how people get into their country. So if the program is implemented incorrectly, if you start attracting the wrong crowd, if you don't implement the program correctly with the good due diligence, thorough due diligence process, then the policy is going to hurt the locals the most, because now Europe Union is going to come back to El Salvador and say, hey, we're going to shut down the visa-free treaty with you. Anybody who's got the passport from 2020 and on, or even anybody at all with El Salvador passport, no longer has visa-free access to Europe Union. And like all the Latin America, they already don't have access to United States, to Canada. They already have hard time traveling up north. Now, if they're going to start having hard time traveling to Europe, that's going to really hurt them. So this is one of my biggest concerns. I don't know how much pressure the country is going to get because of that. And I don't know if they're going to be able to implement thorough due diligence. But I addressed my concerns I was reached out by people who are involved with the program. They asked a lot of great questions. So let's see if that takes place. Yeah.
So outside of like the donation, then what is something that, you know, obviously $1 million is, you know, a lot of money, and, you know, depending on how many people utilize this, could be very beneficial for El Salvador just from like a financial perspective. But, you know, you obviously you raise some of your concerns about the type of people that this could attract. You know, what are some of the benefits that, you know, implementing a program like this that you could foresee like El Salvador kind of benefiting from? Is it just kind of bringing more high net worth individuals potentially? Or is there something like maybe deeper that allowing more people to migrate to the country and kind of have that citizenship can benefit?
For those who are actually relocating to El Salvador, there's a very straightforward and quite easy immigration policy for those who work remotely that is going to cost you $100. Mm-hmm. So if you're really relocating, that's one thing. But I think this program is just very on brand with what they're trying to do in the world as a country. So they do talk a lot about more freedom to the individual. They do talk a lot about bringing the power back from state to the individual, separating state and money. And now we're looking at the pure capitalism on a nation state level, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, nation state capitalism. If you can pick and choose the service provider for your government state services, meaning that you can buy a passport and now you're a citizen of a country, that's the whole sovereign individual thesis. When countries now compete for its citizens, compete for the fruits of their labor. And I definitely have a big hopium in this regard. That's what I do for a living. That's my philosophy. That's what I believe in. And if more countries jump on board with that, that's going to be great. Because again, it brings competition between nation state service providers. And in just like in every capitalistic environment, there are going to be two forces, the price race to the bottom and the quality race to the top. And I believe capitalism is the way to go, even mm-hmm. on a nation state level, if they still exist. So I think that's just very on brand with everything that they say they believe in.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with that as well. But all right, I'm going to play devil's advocate here, because a lot of people in the because space, especially, almost think like, you know, Bukele can't do any wrong. Like El Salvador, every move that they make is very beneficial. But I heard something when I was down in El Salvador for adopting Bitcoin that has kind of made me, you know, think a little bit differently about it. Somebody kind of framed it to me while I was at the conference that it's almost like colonialism, so to speak, where it's like, you know, the Americans or, you know, whoever's coming down there kind of teaching the, you know, El Salvador was a third world country at the time. They're still, you know, they're on the rise and I think they're going in a great direction, but, you know, us kind of coming down there and telling them, hey, you need Bitcoin, you know, this is kind of why you need it, and kind of coaching them through that. And then now they're using, you know, Chivo, kind of a custodial wallet, just because of like the government's telling them this. So I guess from that perspective, what do you think, I guess the perception, I mean, of the locals kind of seeing all these things kind of get passed. Like, I mean, obviously you're not an El Salvadorian or anything like that, but, you know, it seems like Bukele is trying to bring in people from everywhere else. Obviously he is it's going to benefit the people of El Salvador, but at a certain point, it's like, I kind of think of, is it almost like Americans telling El Salvadorians, like, this is what's good for you. And that could kind of go down a wrong path. Is that something that, you know, seeing all these programs roll out that could potentially, I guess, worry you or maybe be a concern in the future?
Yeah, there are a few things that you can't force onto people. Just to name a few, it would be probably freedom, religion, and Bitcoin.
Yeah.
All these are opt-in choices. People choose what they believe in. People choose what kind of freedom they want to see. So with Bitcoin, again, you can't force it onto anybody. They have to understand the value of it and get on board. With El Salvador, I mean, El Salvador was in a very, very bad position. They were just like us at the bottom of the printing machine hierarchy, right? So they are on US dollar standard because their currency already died, their national currency. and they have absolutely no access to the money printer. So they have to do something. They had to, just like us plebs, get on the best option there is available, which is Bitcoin. Yes, people in the country probably do not fully understand why and how it works. And also, they don't necessarily hedge against the same thing we do. And they also don't have the capital to play with. Like, when you live paycheck to paycheck, the volatility of Bitcoin is not going to work out for you. So I understand that it's going to be hard for locals to get on board. But I believe with every education step, they're just gonna realize that it is a blessing and not something that is forced on them.
Yeah, that's fair to say. Yeah, and I agree with that too. I just, you know, I've kind of gone through this thought experiment, and then, you know, when I got the opportunity to interview you, it's just kind of, you know, the way that you present the Plan B passports and everything like that, I just think it's very interesting because, you know, as an American, you don't really think of opting out of the American citizenship, you know, and especially like now, I feel like a lot more people are more open to the idea. But, you know, I guess I grew up here in Texas in Austin, and in high school, we would sing a Pledge of Allegiance to the United States flag and the Texas flag. And we were taught, you know, America was the best country on earth and all this kind of stuff. But, you know, as I'm getting older, it seems like more or less and less people think that way and think more of like on a global scale of things. So, you know, as you've kind of dove into this Plan B passport business and kind of like, you know, figured out the intricacies of multiple countries and kind of had to think of more of the geopolitical lens, do you think that this is going to be, I guess, a growing trend in the future where people are going to start to look for either maybe, you know, a second citizenship based on, you know, something that their parents have or where their parents are from or grandparents or what have you, or like, you know, more of the investment type of option to get multiple citizenships going forward?
Yeah, I feel like it is getting much easier to relocate all around the world, especially due to remote work being available. But I also realized, I mean, more and more people relocate these days, for sure. If you look at migration numbers, the trend is up by a lot. Funny enough, COVID was a blessing in this regard too, because there was nothing to do in your hometown anymore. Everybody worked remotely. You could pick up your computer and work from somewhere else. So that kind of turn the switch in everybody's head, like, hey, I don't have to stay in New York and pay $3,400 for 600 square feet. So as we go further, again, a lot of this is my hopium. Like, this is what I live on a daily basis. So I want to believe that I'm in a bubble. Everybody in my bubble has a second passport, looking to relocate, seeking options of what place in the world would provide them with the best lifestyle for their family. And I feel like we are moving forward in this direction. The competition between states are rising, and with internet, of course, like first with internet spreading information, now we have all those viral videos showing people how Americans can live abroad. And now it's not one directional immigration where everybody's going for American dream. I believe it is going to be a bigger and bigger market every year. But also, I mean, that's a bubble of like people who are well off. Just being able to hedge against your home country, I feel like that's becoming more and more common, where people realize that they're not safe anywhere, no matter what country they're in. There's always a risk of geopolitics going south and their country being involved in an international war. So you want to hedge against that. You want to make sure that you're not part of somebody else's war. And you want to be able to just have an exit strategy, like get the fuck out.
Yeah, no, I mean, I agree 100%. And I think COVID really opened a lot of people's eyes for that. I mean, I definitely opened mine too. I mean, just looking at, you know, the Canadian truckers convoy, obviously, you know, that was a big use case for Bitcoin and everything else. But at the same time, made me realize like, hey, you know, Canada's just north of us. I mean, pretty far north from here, from Texas, but, you know, the closest country north from the United States, and then they shut down bank accounts. People couldn't leave, and you know, it just seemed like this big ordeal. Like you couldn't even travel to the country right next door because of, you know, a jab here or there. So it definitely opened my eyes to, you know, international travel and just kind of being able to escape based on, you know, ruling and force and enforcement. So from, I guess, like a region basis, where do you think is the most, I guess, like open and beneficial region to start exploring that second passport for, I guess, the average person, like, you know, say you want to live in Austin for 6 months of the year and then, you know, kind of work remotely 6 months of the year?
Yeah. So right now we definitely have a huge growing trend towards Latin America. Mm-hmm. Latin American lifestyle is becoming more and more close to what we have in the US. You have, again, access to all the services and things that you want to Amazon overnight. You now can do the same thing in Mexico, for example, which wasn't always the case. In terms of relocation, that's probably the most common, the most interesting place right now. But if you're looking for a second passport, I'm really looking forward to Eastern European, like Balkan community, mm-hmm. to start launching those programs, because they are on the mainland. They're not island nations. They're not part of the EU, but they're close enough to Europe, like they are Europe. And when those countries start launching citizenship by investment program, I'll be definitely on it. And we see Montenegro has a program. Serbia has a kind of program. So those are definitely interesting to hedge against the Western world. Now, again, it's very custom tailored. Like if you're just hedging, it's very custom tailored depending on where you're coming from, what's your first citizenship is, what's your family count looks like. Is it 5 kids? Is it just you as a single applicant? So that will play a role as well. And then geopolitics, again, changing all the time. So it's not like you're going to get it done today and you're taking care for the rest of your life. Mm-hmm. The international relationship play a huge role. So once things start to change, you might need to find another hedge that will be better off for you.
Yeah, understood. And you mentioned the timeline of the El Salvador one being like 2 weeks. What is, like, I guess, like kind of an average if you had to put one out there?
Yeah, if we're talking about citizenship by investment program, again, let's talk about Caribbeans or Turkey. We're talking about 6 to 8 months.
Oh, 6 to 8 months. Wow. So the 2 weeks is just like extremely, extremely short.
It's unbelievable.
Yeah. Truly. That's insane. Okay. So then, yeah, we've talked about geopolitics a little bit. So obviously, you know, there's the war kind of escalating, it seems like, in Europe and maybe in China and Taiwan and other places as well. So how does, if you're, a resident of that country, how do those things affect, you know, the applications? Is there almost like, I guess, almost like blackballing in a sense, where like if you're, a Russian citizen or a Ukrainian citizen, depending on what side of the war this country that you're applying for is on, you know, does that kind of delay things and kind of make the access less, open?
Yeah, definitely. That's why I always say get it before you need it, because once you need it, you might not have access to those programs. Mm-hmm. Both Russian and Ukrainian applicants cannot apply for citizenship by investment program in any of the Caribbeans right now.
Wow.
Russians, because they're banned from a lot of things, and Ukrainians, because the countries cannot perform thorough due diligence on you because the country is in a state of war. So now the only jurisdiction they can go for with citizenship by investment program, it would be Turkey and now El Salvador, basically. So again, they don't have many options because it's too late. Same goes for some other countries, obviously, you know, North Korea, Iran cannot apply for citizenship by investment program in the Caribbeans. And again, it's changing. They probably will have to wait for like another 5-7 years and the program will get reopened. Same goes for Russian and Ukrainian applicants. Sometimes they say we no longer allow them, and then they open a window of opportunity, which is like, we need capital, follow the money.
Yeah.
Always follow the money. That's what the nation state capitalism is about. That's their motivation. So follow the money, follow the incentives, and We definitely see it in the world of investment migration.
Yeah, 100%. So it seems like El Salvador has kind of been almost like an experiment. I don't know if that's a great word to use, but essentially, you know, obviously making Bitcoin legal tender, they're, you know, Bukele is kind of pushing the needle a little bit with, you know, this investment passport and our investment citizenship and things like that. You know, we just saw Argentina kind of not make Bitcoin legal tender, but say that contracts can now be accepted in Bitcoin and I think other cryptocurrencies as well, but obviously Bitcoin. And so it seems like Argentina is not necessarily following the exact path of El Salvador, but, you know, obviously, you know, the close proximity, it seems like they're kind of keeping a close eye. Do you think, like, a lot of, you know, I mean, we've brought up Latin America a couple times, but do you think that that's going to be a growing trend where Latin America is almost going to start to become, you know, almost the freedom area of the globe with not only just Bitcoin, but with, you know, you see the way you see passport regulations and citizenship regulations go?
Definitely feels like it. Basically all of Latin American countries have the digital nomad visa right now, or financial solvency visa,
okay,
which is literally asking for capital. So they will welcome you to the country as long as you have 50 grand in your bank account, because they know that now you're bringing in capital, you're going to spend it here, you're going to hire a couple people, you're going to create jobs, and your spendings are going to be coming from abroad. So it's not that you generate your capital here and just do the velocity of money inside the country, but more like you bring your own capital from abroad. And that's very cool. It's also gradually then suddenly, right? We have El Salvador really stepping in, leading the game. Now we see other countries trying to get on board, Brazil, Argentina, and Venezuela probably has no choice but to join the same thing, again, because they're in such a shit show currency-wise. So I think Latin America might become like the next Europe in the Renaissance era, where they're clearly on a rise. They haven't been involved in many wars for a while. Culturally, the respect for governments within the local audience is not high. Like in the US, we have this whole heroes in blue, obey the government, be fearful of government. You go to Latin America and you see how the relationship between authority and the locals is completely different, because there's not this just insane amount of respect, because they do treat them as like, you're there to provide my services and you leave off of my money. So I'm gonna treat you the way I want to treat you. And that's also almost necessary for a country that wants to have more freedom. Americans are still good because they have this, I don't know, spirit of like asking for more freedom. At least we can do that. You mentioned Canada. I wonder when America is going to start allowing political asylum applications for Canadians, because it's always been the case that political asylum was given to some Latin American countries. But at this point, I feel like Canadians should be able to apply for that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think, well, that, I don't know, the current party in office likes Trudeau in a sense, so, or at least is a little bit more aligned with Trudeau than the previous party that was in office. But you mentioned, you know, bringing like $50,000-ish over in your bank account. Is there any potential issues, I guess, if you apply for these like investment or digital nomad passports, where, you know, maybe like a bank can see that, like, hey, you're applying for another citizenship, like raising any flags in a sense that way?
Not really. So with financial solvency visas, you're not really contributing any money anywhere.
Okay.
You're just providing your bank statements showing that you have enough money to support your life for the next 2 years. So they give you a 2-year residency card. 2 years later, you come back and say, hey, I still got 50K in my bank account. Give me 2 more years. And after 5 years of being a resident in the country, you will be able to apply for a naturalization process, meaning that if you pass the history exam, language exam in the country, these are not very hard. You don't have to be like truly fluent. You will be able to become a citizen now. We will welcome you just like one of ours. And basically almost every country in Latin America has this program.
Okay. So I guess, Yeah, so we were talking about Canada for a second because I kind of want to go back to there because I do have a lot of I guess friends that are Canadian. So in a sense, like, obviously it depends a little bit where your citizenship lies. I guess globally, is there a big difference between having like a U.S. citizenship compared to a Canadian citizenship?
So there's one huge difference that is citizenship-based taxation, and that's where Americans are actually losing to Canadians. Really? So as a Canadian, you have basically visa-free access to the same countries as America does, right? Uh-huh. You can travel to all of Europe, all of Latin America, almost all of it. But what's cool about being Canadian is once you leave Canada and you prove Canadian IRS, whatever it's called, that you're no longer a tax resident of the country, meaning you shut down your bank accounts, you no longer have income in Canada, you no longer use hospitals, whatever, medical system in the country, you don't have to file with the Canadian tax unit. In America, with citizenship-based taxation, no matter where you live, where your money come from, you always have to file with Uncle Sam, and then you have to navigate the double taxation treaties and all that stuff. That's one thing that Americans need to fight against is citizenship-based taxation.
Yeah, so for citizen-based taxation then, all right, so if you got one of these digital nomad type of visas where you're living abroad for, 2 years, because it's like an additional citizenship and it's not, permanent, you wouldn't be able to, I guess, like get rid of the American citizenship, so to speak. So you would still have to pay Uncle Sam the taxes then, huh?
So first we have to clarify citizenship versus residency, okay, right? In order to renounce your U.S. citizenship, you have to have another citizenship. Residency is not going to fly. Residency is just your allowance to live in a country. It allows you to stay. It allows you sometimes to work in the country, open bank accounts. You cannot vote. You cannot share your residency with get married and share your residency with somebody else. However, once you become a citizen, you can now vote. You can share your citizenship with your spouse and all that stuff. And then you can renounce American citizenship, right? So residency is like a long-term visa allowing you to live in the country full-time. Citizenship that comes with a passport is a different thing. That's one thing. Now, let's say as an American, you move to Mexico. You still work remotely with, let's say, American company in tech. Again, I'm not an attorney. I'm not a tax advisor and all that stuff. Don't take it as a financial advice. Basically, you will be able to save on some taxes still because you will be able to not pay income tax for the first $110,000 of your income because you're not a resident. You will file as a non-resident of the United States. But with capital gains, you will have to navigate all that because now a new country already wants to tax you because they want your capital.
Yeah.
The old country still wants to tax you. Now, America has double tax treaty with a lot of countries in the world, probably the most amount of countries in the world. So you won't have to be taxed twice, but you will have to navigate that if you want to stay in the white.
Gotcha. Gotcha. All right. So I've been thinking about this the whole time. Like, how did you get into this? Obviously, there's Bitcoin with like the freedom money and like kind of, peer to peer and kind of avoiding it that way. But, how did you find yourself in the passport business?
It all came together very clearly. I think those two industries go hand in hand. Again, power to the individual, take back the power from the state and have options, have optionality, right? Bitcoin gives you optionality. And it gives you like self-custody of an asset while having multiple passports basically gives you self-custody of yourself because now you're not under monopoly of one government that the state has over you. So I'm an immigrant myself, obviously. Katie, the Russian, was born and raised in Russia. I moved to the U.S. 7 years ago, and I realized that as a non-citizen of this country, I sometimes have more rights and freedom than you guys do. I can open bank accounts without social security number. As a non-citizen, I don't have the citizenship-based taxation obligation, so I can leave. And there are a lot of those things. But I actually started playing the game of jurisdictional arbitrage on a very small scale. Like, if you're getting pulled over and you're showing them a driver license from another country, they're getting lost. They're like, oh, no, I'm not going to send the fine to Russia or something like this. They're just going to let you go. My dad, who has Florida driver license, has been showing his Florida driver license in Russia to every cop. And they just want to take picture with that because they're like, whoa, that's cool. So I started playing this game of jurisdictional arbitrage on a very small scale. But I realized there is a higher game of that. And pretty much as I was learning about Bitcoin, I realized I also was going down the rabbit hole of flag theory. And my definition of flag theory is this concept of limiting your dependency on any one particular state by obtaining more flags. And by flags, I mean, again, residency, citizenship, bug out homes, finding a tribe, a community, making sure you can relocate to another country when it's time. And Bitcoin is a huge part of this flag theory because now you have stateless money, right? Mm-hmm. The cyberspace money, I guess. So that's a huge flag as well. And in Bitcoin space, I was just talking my ass about the flag theory, how everybody needs a second password. And I was learning so much about it that I could start providing like expert opinion without having any product to offer. So I was just tweeting about it and people were sliding in my DMs and asking more questions, and I would give them full numbers, tell them where to go, where to find all that. And then I was like, you know what? I have expertise. I'm going to start Plan B Password.
That's nice. Yeah. So then I guess it seems like the freedom aspect of Bitcoin is really like kind of resonated with you this whole time. And you were kind of playing the game, like you said, on a small scale. So I guess, is that the aspect of Bitcoin that truly resonated with you first? And what would you say, like, I guess kind of like led you down the orange pill rabbit hole?
I was pretty supposed to be a Bitcoiner. I grew up in Russia. I've seen hyperinflation multiple times in my lifetime. I've had my bank accounts just frozen for no reason. As an 18-year-old, what could I have possibly done to have my bank accounts frozen? So seeing all that, I realized that they have way too much control over our money. Mm-hmm. And then I went to economics and finance school, where I again realized that they cannot explain what's going on with the financial system overall, why our local currency keeps dropping compared to any other currency around. Like, nothing could explain it. And I realized that maybe this university is not going to give me the knowledge that I want. And that's when I decided to move to the United States. And I thought I would just go into college here and try different kind of education, more hands-on, less theoretical. But then I never ended up going to college, which was one of the best decisions of my life. I just got on Twitter and got orange filled. I think just all my experiences in life led me to understand the system is wrong, and I just had to find the right knowledge to lead me to Bitcoin.
Yeah. And that's interesting because a lot of Americans that I meet, you know, I interact with people in like the traditional finance space as well as like the Bitcoin space. And everybody in the traditional finance space has some sort of education, like whether it's economics or has worked in banking or done something that's kind of like led them down that, you know, I guess rabbit hole, I don't know, but almost like think in that sort of sense. So I think it's really interesting that you've thought, I guess, outside the box, like, why is the system this way, even though you were getting the education to kind of like learn it that way and you were questioning it. So I guess, you know, do you think that your life experiences have kind of caused you to almost like question like anything, like, you know, kind of the Bitcoin mantra, like don't trust, verify? It's kind of like, you know, your life experiences have kind of like led you to that point, which kind of, I guess, pushed you down the rabbit hole almost.
Definitely. My childhood, I mean, growing up in post-Soviet space already was a pretty good base for that, because that's when people realize that they don't have, again, this respect for authority. We tried, like in Russia, we tried monarchy and then communism and then democracy over the last 100 years, and nothing worked. So maybe we should not rely on government to solve our problems and just take it all into our hands. And you just see in Russia within the people. So growing up in this environment with my family also being very freedom-minded, my dad was a prosecutor when I was born, and he quit the system because he realized the justice system is absolute bullshit. Again, it's all the game of incentives. And he and my mom became entrepreneurs, and they truly believe that this is the only social elevator that can ever work. You can not go to college and step up your life. The only way for you to do it is through entrepreneurship. So I grew up very entrepreneurial. Like at the age of 9, they gave me like a fishing stick. It's a metaphor. They said, there's a music festival going on. Do you want to go sell those bright rave bracelets? We will help you buy them, but then you'll pay us back the cost and whatever profits you have. So for next 4 years, my sister and I have been making tons of money off of this music festival. And they would incentivize it. Like they would very much direct us on what to do without taking any responsibility for our business. And then I also got into sailing, right? I got into Russian national team when I was 11.
Wow.
So I started traveling the world by myself. Again, a lot of self-responsibility on a single-handed boat as an 11-year-old girl somewhere in Italy or Spain. So I was just growing up given a lot of self-responsibility and freedom. And when you grow up like this, you don't learn to rely on the system. You don't learn to rely on whoever the authority next to you is. So I'm very thankful to my parents for that. And then I'm very thankful that one day I just called my dad and said, I'm dropping out of the best economics and finance school of Russia and moving to the US. And all he said was, well, cheers for that, I guess. Like, I was given a lot of freedom, and because of that, I never been a problematic child, and I never had to break up with authority.
Yeah, that's interesting. It seems like, you know, I guess I want to hear your perspective now on, like, after you've lived in America, you said for like 7 years or so, right? Yeah, so I want to hear the perspective of, like, I guess, of hearing how people are raising their kids now in the United States, and maybe, I mean, obviously, you got a lot of Bitcoiners here in Austin, but I'm sure you've gotten some exposure of like maybe the more helicopter parents and things like that. That's kind of the more in the American culture. So I'll give you the floor here to kind of hear your opinion on how like Americans are sort of raising kids now and what you, I guess, kind of think about it.
I'm very much in a bubble. You need to understand. I moved here 7 years ago, got into Bitcoin right away. All my friends are Bitcoiners.
Okay.
All the families around are Bitcoiners. Of course, I have some exposure to what the system is like. And there are a lot of things that completely blow my mind, even not because of my like libertarian mindset, but even just comparing to Russia. The family unit seem to be much stronger in Russia. Like one funny example, my husband, who's American, came over to my small town in Russia. And he was like, are we in a really, really nice town? I'm like, what do you mean? I haven't seen a single homeless person. And we went through, like, we walked through downtown. We've been walking for 4 days, not a single homeless person. Like, yeah, well, all the would-be homeless people live with their moms because their mom never disowned them, because this strength of family unit and supporting each other no matter what is still there in Russia. Another thing is we have, like, 3 years of maternity leave. And here in the U.S.,
like 3 months,
not even 5 weeks.
Yeah.
5 weeks. And you hand your child, like you just spent 9 months growing a human in your belly. You're highly attached and you did so much work to have this human that is half you, half of the life of your life. And you have to hand him or her to somebody else to raise them. It breaks my heart and my mind just thinking of that. But that's what Americans have to do because it's almost impossible to live off of single income.
Mm-hmm.
So all of that really breaks the family bond, in my opinion. And then the kids are being raised by the state instead of being raised by parents. That's what I also see with the school system, is that there's a lot more political education, sex education that's going on in school that is completely not part of a curriculum in Russia. Like, we just do math, language, and history and all that stuff. There's no opinion that is being fed to you through 11 years of school education. While here, parents don't have that power to educate their child on those little things. So the school takes over again. And now we see where that turns.
Yeah, I think it's just, you know, it all kind of like leads back to the money and inflation, right? Because you just, it's getting harder and harder to live off of one income unless somebody, you know, does super, super well to have kids. Like, you essentially need that, the multiple sources of income, which is pretty unfortunate. But, you know, obviously you live here in Austin, and you kind of, it sounds like you chose Austin initially. Is that right?
No, I actually moved here after I met my husband. I wanted to live in Austin already. I actually was in Mexico.
Okay.
During COVID, I spent a lot of time in Mexico, and I moved back because I knew it was time to get married, and I absolutely could not understand how to date a Latin man. So I was like, I'm moving back to the U.S. I'm going to find a husband and have kids. And so I did. I came to Austin, did deaths, met my husband, and a year later we had a child.
Well, that's awesome. Okay, so then what's your opinion of Austin? So you've been here for a decent amount of time. Austin, you know, I grew up here. So when I was growing up here, I guess just for preference, there was, you know, a lot of downtown. There was a lot of cranes, a lot of things that you probably know downtown were not here. Mopac was bad traffic, but not even close to the way it is right now, where you can't even drive on it at 5 o'clock. Like where my parents' neighborhood is, Steiner Ranch, there was like 45 minutes to the closest grocery store. Now they have one in their neighborhood, and, you know, all these changes. Every time I come back, I'm just blown away. So I guess, like, from your perspective, with seeing obviously a lot of Bitcoiners come here, we're in Pleb Lab, there's a lot of great things going on. Like, you know, there's definitely positives going on here in Austin, but I see, like, a lot of, you know, the homeless population obviously getting a little bit worse with, you know, the way the city's going. So what's your opinion of, like, the way Austin is going?
I recently voiced my concern, and the way I said it, I said, I don't want to be the San Francisco citizen who still thinks San Francisco is good while everybody around realizes that it's going to shit.
Yeah,
I want to make sure it doesn't happen with me in Austin, because I created a perfect bubble. It's literally the first time I'm in downtown in months, probably.
Yeah.
I don't go north of the river at all. I'm hanging out south of the river. We have amazing community of Bitcoiners. Anywhere I step my foot, people are philosophically aligned with me. Like, I found a perfect pediatrician for my child. I found a perfect healthcare provider for my pregnancy that is outside of the hospital, outside of all the traditional childbirth systematic setting. I have found, like, anything that I need, Austin has provided so far. But again, I realize it's not because I just go to a random shop and it's always philosophically aligned with me. It's because I seek for those people, and, like, just like node by node, we are on the same protocol, we connect, and there is this perfect network of people that I have in Austin. And both my husband and I, we work remotely. With my knowledge of jurisdictional arbitrage, we could probably live anywhere, but yet we still choose Austin. Part of it, family. Part of it, our tribe. That's very important to me as a young mother who's still in her childbearing years. I want to make sure that I have my sisterhood that is kind of in the same stage of life, that we have the village. You know, they say it takes a village to raise a child. So we build this village here in Austin, and it's beautiful, and I absolutely feel blessed about it. And that's why I don't see myself moving anywhere anytime soon. But again, I don't want to be oblivious about what's going on around, and I want to make sure I pull the trigger at the right time.
Yeah. No,
thankfully, I have exit strategy.
Yeah. It definitely seems like you, of all people, is definitely going to be prepared if Austin becomes, I guess, San Francisco 2.0. But there's a lot of great stuff going on down here. It's just interesting, the perspective I hear from Bitcoiners that have moved here, you know, as somebody that grew up here. And I've kind of gotten away because, you know, I guess everybody that I know here now is like Bitcoiners. But the people that I went to high school with are, you know, I guess definitely different. Have a different philosophical mindset than I do. But You know, that's not, neither here nor there. I really appreciate your time and making the trip down to downtown to come for this interview. So why don't you tell people a little bit where they can find out more about Plan B, Passport, and find out more about you.
Yeah, definitely. Katie the Russian on Twitter. I basically, these days, I tweet either about motherhood or about passports, not much about Bitcoin anymore because Bitcoin just became this base layer of my life that I don't have to pay attention to anymore, funny enough. And then on Instagram, the universe of Katie, that's more of a motherhood stuff. And planbpassport.com is all the professional things regarding jurisdictional arbitrage. You can schedule a free call consultancy to just go over your options, your needs and goals, and we'll help. We'll be happy to lead you to the right knowledge that you need to acquire.
There we go. And I'll put all that in the show notes. So Katie, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you.